What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, how are you? Welcome back to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we are here. We are live on this Monday, January the 5th. It's a new year, a new month, and here's our phone number, which is not new. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email if you wish to do that. The address is ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer. Matt Gabinski is our phone screener, and Ace McKay handling social media today. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, just put that in the chat screen, if you would, please, and we'll take it from there. I'm Tom Price. Very glad to be back with my dear friend, Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Well, I'm doing pretty good.
Comparatively, yes, I would say so.
You know, David, if you wanted a little time off around the holidays, you just had to say so. You didn't have to come up with all these phony excuses.
Well, you mean like having a vocal hematoma that took my voice out for 2 weeks, catching the flu, a secondary sinus infection, and now breaking the fourth metatarsal of my left foot.
Unbelievable. This guy will go to any length to duck out of a little work. Honestly, my dear friend, I'm so glad to have you back
with
us.
I'm really glad to be back.
And you are feeling better.
Yeah, I'm about 95%.
We'll take it.
Except for the broken foot.
See, 95%, we can work with that.
I can work with 95%.
We're going to lead off here with a question from our EWTN listener comment line.
Yeah, hello. This is Juan from Cathedral City, California. I just had a question on the beatific vision. Wanted to see if Dr. Anders can elaborate more on that. I don't have a good understanding of, you know, what that means, and here when in the next life. But if you can kind of elaborate more on that, please. Thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah, thanks. So there are a number of passages of the New Testament that speak about the vision of God. Jesus says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." St. Paul says, "Now we see as through a glass darkly, but then we will see face to face." St. John writes in 1 John, "Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known, but we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." So the promise of the vision of God, the vision of Christ apparently in his divine glory, seeing clearly as opposed to through a glass darkly.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the church has inferred from this is the doctrine that the just upon death will see God in his essence, that they'll know God in an immediate intuitive way. Not through the mediation of any creature. And let me unpack that, what that means. So, you know, right now we know God in a mediated way. We know God, say, as the creator, because we can infer his existence from the things that have been made. The most intimate way that we know God in this life is through the mediation of the incarnation, because the humanity of Christ is assumed to the divinity, and so Jesus is a divine person, and we confess his divinity, but we can only perceive the humanity. You know, if Jesus comes walking down the street, what I'm going to see is a human being. You know, I'm not going to be able to visually grasp or have a sense experience of the divinity as such. It's still mediated to me, right, through Christ's divine actions, his divine words. But we're going to know God in an immediate way without the mediation of any creature in an intuitive vision, kind of like the way you would know the reality of your own consciousness, right? I mean, you know, I'm not a big Cartesian, but the point that Descartes made when he said, "I think, therefore I am," is that the fact that I am a thinking being is indubitable to me, because I can't call it into question without using the very faculty that I'm questioning.
Sure,
I have to think in order to deny the fact that I'm thinking.
And
like it's a contradiction in terms. It's an oxymoron, right?
Yeah.
That level of immediacy is the degree to which we'll have an experience of the essence of God. Now, what is that like? Well, all we know about the essence of God is the essence of God is the ground, the source, the origin, the foundation of everything that's true, good, and beautiful. So it's an experience, an immediate intuitive vision of infinite goodness, infinite beauty, infinite truth. What will that be like? Well, I think Paul's caution that eye hasn't seen, ear hasn't heard, and it hasn't entered into the heart of man what God has in store for those who love him is very apt at this point. I mean, these are words we can use, but I mean, how could we possibly express in language what that would be like?
Sure. Appreciate your call to our listener comment line. Calls are coming in right now at 833-288-EWTN. We'll get to the phones in just a moment. Question here from Arden in Louisville. St. Paul had to confront and correct St. Peter in Acts of the Apostles because he was not associating with Gentiles. Well, St. Peter was wrong even after Pentecost. So how can a pope today claim to be infallible? I have never heard this addressed.
Oh, yeah. Actually, absolutely. So I really appreciate that. So the definition of infallibility that the church uses absolutely takes into account Peter's lapse of judgment and other papal missteps over the centuries. The doctrine of infallibility does not mean that popes can't do something stupid or even immoral, right? And Peter's action was at least grossly imprudent, and he acted out of fear and prejudice. Now, Peter did not stand up and make some sort of infallible pronouncement that the Gentiles are forever cut off from God or something like that.
Yeah.
He just personally held back from, sharing pizza with them because he was embarrassed by the arrival of people from Jerusalem who took a dim view of such things. So he kind of caved into peer pressure. So he was morally weak. But he didn't make a doctrinally erroneous statement. Now, but I'll do you one better. The church actually contemplates the possibility that a pope could make an erroneous statement. In fact, popes have done so. When they're acting as private theologians, when they're giving out their own opinion on a matter, there's no guarantee that what they say is infallibly true. So the charism of infallibility is very strictly delimited to those acts when the pope intends to define a matter of faith or morals that is to be binding on the whole Christian people in view of it having been revealed by God. That's a very restricted set of circumstances.
Arden, thanks for listening to us in Louisville. In a moment, we'll talk with Doug in Oregon, Ruth in Pennsylvania, and hopefully you at 833-288-EWTN. It is Call to Communion. We are live on this Monday with Dr. David Anders. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. I am so glad that EWTN is available for you on the Laudate app. If you have that on your phone, it's a wonderful thing. You can check out the readings for the day, check out many things, and you can check out EWTN Radio because you can listen there right now. If you've got the Laudate app on your phone, check out EWTN's live stream. Just open it up, click on EWTN, and you're good to go. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Doug in Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey there, Doug. Happy New Year. What's on your mind today, sir?
Happy New Year, Tom. And Happy New Year, David.
Thank
you for taking my call. The last sentence of the Memorare says, O Mother of the Word Incarnate, despise not my petitions, but in thy mercy hear and answer me. I looked up the word despise. It means to regard with contempt or scorn, to dislike intensely, to look down upon with disfavor or contempt. And Pope Pius IX actually wrote that prayer based on the Latin despicere, D-E-S-P-I-C-E-R-E, which means to despise, with the same meaning. And apparently it came from a prayer in the 15th century, Ad Sanctitatis Tua Pedes Dulcissima Virgo Maria. But my question is, why would a sinless person like Mary even consider despising anything?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I really appreciate the question. And thank you also for the history lesson on the Memorare.
Yeah.
You gave me some facts I didn't know there, so I appreciate that. Two things to say. First of all, we should never derive dogmatic theology from the language of devotional prayers. It should go the other way around. We should compose devotional prayers grounded in the dogmas of the church and not the other way around. And the genre of devotional prayer, particularly these vocal prayers that have been handed down by sacred tradition, often have a great deal of the poetic about them. And they use imagery and symbolism and sentiment that sometimes is drawn from another era and another culture. And all that has to be taken into consideration when weighing their theological significance. That being said, I can think of all kinds of reasons why the mother of the Word incarnate might despise one of my petitions. And I'm thinking about that icon of gospel music, Janis Joplin. And you may remember her a cappella song, "Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, so help, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?" Right? And everything I know from the Gospels suggests that that is a prayer that Mary would probably despise, and that she would have very low regard for what motivated the petition, and would consider it kind of a grossly inappropriate request. The point of prayer in Catholic tradition is not to compel God to do our will. It is to compel our will to the will of God, is to ultimately change us to want what God wants for us, not to tell God what we think we need. And you know, which is why when we ask God to buy me your Mercedes-Benz, the answer to that prayer is, generally speaking, no.
You know what? You hear it all on Catholic Radio. Am I right? You hear it all on Catholic Radio. Doug, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion. We are live on this Monday, the first Monday of the new year, here on EWTN. Let's go now to Ruth, a first-time caller from Pennsylvania, listening on the EWTN app. Hello, Ruth. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I was wondering, what is the proper way to dispose of a Bible or other type of religious artifact?
Yeah, sure. So I am not aware of there being any particular canonical obligation imposed on Catholics to dispose of old Bibles in one way versus another. It is customary for items that have been blessed to often to be buried in a sacred place. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not uncommon when ground is broken for a new church as they're laying the cornerstone. A petition will go out, "Hey, do you have any blessed items you need to dispose of?" And they'll, you know, put them under the cornerstone of the church as they're building and that sort of thing. I've never heard of somebody doing that with Bibles. So I'm not aware that there's any specific directive that says you must dispose of a Bible in this way rather than that. Now, I understand the sentiment. I mean, one feels odd about treating with contempt or as a thing of no account a copy of the Word of God, even if it's, you know, been disfigured somehow. It seems kind of funny to just toss it offhandedly in the garbage. So I don't know that that's immoral, but, you know, it does grate the sentiments. And so, you know, one thing to do might be to take it to the parish and leave it with the priest and say, you know, "Here, do with this what you think needs to be done with it, mm-hmm. Father."
Certainly could. Ruth, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you. And we've got a couple lines open here at 833-288-EWTN as we're getting back into the groove here, 833-288-3986, or send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com. There's a rather lengthy email here from Jason in South Carolina. "Dr. Anders, my wife and I are currently not Catholic. I grew up Presbyterian, PCA. She grew up Southern Baptist. Through independent research and reading and talking with current Catholics, I have recently been questioning many beliefs that are now popular in Protestant churches. We have been attending Mass together for several weeks now. We're talking about our faith incessantly. I have more time to read these days and research than she does, and so I like to inform her of my findings. However, we are not on the same page. She's gravitating toward her original Reformed Baptist beliefs. This is creating great tension, stress, and arguments in our marriage. What is your advice for how I should handle our belief differences in marriage? Thank you both for your ministry. Jason in South Carolina.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I really appreciate the question. So you said you grew up Presbyterian, a lot of different kinds of Presbyterians, and I would hate to generalize in a way that would cover all of them, but, you know, I grew up Presbyterian, and I know at least a fairly large chunk of Presbyterians would fall into the following description. It's really important for them, for other people, to agree with them on theology. And okay. They are highly invested. I know I was. They're highly invested in making sure that everybody around them has heard the right doctrines and conforms to the right ideas. And that can be a big part of the Presbyterian mindset. So here's a real kind of sea change for you, sort of radical shift. And it's very hard, actually, for former Presbyterians to get their head and their heart wrapped around this. Stop caring what your wife thinks nearly as much as you do, right? And, you know, the Catholic perspective is that all the baptized are Christians in virtue of their baptism, have the right to be called Christians and are children of God, and belong in some way, even a very extended way, to the Catholic Church. There's only one church. There's only one baptism. If you're baptized into Christ, you're baptized into His church, even if in an extended way without full communion, you're still in there. And the kind of the sort of eschatological anxiety that is bred into you as a fundamentalist or a certain kind of Protestant, where you think, well, if my relatives get this question wrong, they're going to burn in hell forever, it does not weigh on the Catholic conscience in quite the same way. And you really can surrender your wife's salvation to the providence of God and trust in divine goodness and believe that the most important thing you need to do in your Christian vocation is to model the charity of Christ towards your spouse, not to browbeat her into agreeing with your every statement. And you know, my experience is that, generally speaking, men and women are kind of put together differently, and there are different things that appeal to them cognitively, right? They're attracted to different sets of ideas that are presented in different ways, or different aspects of the truth that appeal to men and women differently. And again, this is a generalization, and there are exceptions, but most of the guys that I know are more likely, if one member of the couple is more likely to be sort of drawn in by highly abstract, pedantic reasoning, you know, textual exegesis and sort of fine points of elaboration, and the other one is more likely to say, "All right, show me the money, where the rubber hits the road, yeah. Bud. Like, what difference does it make in my life?" It's usually the guy who gets wrapped up in the highly abstract, pedantic argument, and the woman that says, yeah, all that may be true or not, but at the end of the day, who's going to watch my kids when I'm at church? You know, like those kind of practical questions are just much more poignant, generally speaking, in the marriage. And so you're going to ultimately do more to persuade your wife of the truth of the Catholic faith if you talk less and love harder. Right, because that's the ultimate end of the Catholic faith. At the end of the day, if all the doctrines are kind of worthless, if they don't lead to the transformation of your life in charity, right? So love more, talk less. That would be my counsel.
Very good. Thanks so much for that. Here's a question. This actually came in just a couple minutes ago, and then the call dropped, so we weren't able to get it on. But this person called up and said that they were very upset because of the reaction of another motorist, apparently because of this person's pro-life bumper sticker or magnet or something like that. And the person who couldn't get on the air was very upset about that person, that other motorist's reaction. Any counsel there?
Yeah, you know, I'm really sorry about that. I have only had one experience of road rage, and it wasn't my rage, right, in my entire life. I was driving in a local neighborhood in Birmingham, and I must have been lost in thought. Maybe I was listening to EWTN or listening to music. I don't know what I was doing, but obviously I wasn't paying attention to the world around me enough. And apparently I must have been tailgating the guy in front of me. And I don't usually tailgate. It's not my style of driving. But evidently, I was tailgating. And I pulled off the road to go to the parking lot of a grocery store, and the guy who had been behind pulled off after me and backed his car in to block me in, got out of his car, put his finger in my face, and started yelling at me for tailgating him. And I was a little intimidated to say, to say the least. And I was also flabbergasted because I really had no memory of doing it. I wasn't conscious of having done that. And all I could say was, you know, gosh, I'm really sorry. Would you please forgive me?
Yeah.
I mean, I was just, I just ate humble pie and I mea culpa, sure. Mea maxima culpa, you know. You're right, dude. I'm wrong. You're good. I'm bad. I'm sorry, you know. Please forgive me. And he harumphed and he grumphed and he got in his car and drove away. That's the only experience of road rage I've ever had, you know. And I remember the movie War Games, John Badham film. And at the end of the film, there's a computer that's modeling nuclear holocausts, you know, through all these. And the computer is a learning computer and it eventually decides, oh, this is a funny game. The only way to win is not to play. And it's the best line of the film, you know. There are some conflicts where the only way to win is not to play.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what my own sweetheart, Adrienne, would say is pray for that person. If they're that upset and they are just, you know, going off on a big rant or even, you know giving you a salute of some sort, best thing to do is pray for that person.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, let's go to Michael. Michael is in Kansas, Granite City, Illinois, just outside of St. Louis. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Anders.
Hi.
Yeah, I got this. I'm in OCIA. I got this, so I'm new. New person trying to get into the Catholic Church. Holy water and chalk kit yesterday. And my question is, can I sprinkle my grandchildren with it to bless them? And also, if my daughter approves, and if I follow the prescription in Matthew 28:19, can I officially baptize my youngest grandchild, who hasn't been baptized, by sprinkling him with holy water? Or is that reserved for priests alone, minus emergency situations?
Okay, I appreciate the question. Regarding the second question, lay people are allowed to baptize in cases of emergency. If there's somebody's in danger of death, then you can go ahead and baptize them. Outside of the danger of death, the preferred way is for a minister of the church, a deacon or a priest, to baptize the infant or the convert. And the reason why is that baptism does not just establish a relationship between, you know, your personal relationship with Jesus, some privatized thing, but it inaugurates you into the body of Christ, which is the church. You take on that Christian identity and character, and you have obligations that you assume through baptism, rights as well, but also obligations. And so there has to be an expectation on the part of the one doing the baptism, the celebrant, that there's some well-founded hope that this person will, in fact, take up the duties of their state of life as a Christian, that they'll go to Mass, that they'll, you know, attempt to live a holy life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that Christian identity is not reducible to our relationship to the clergy, but it certainly incorporates it, right? I mean, the clergy they're not the only thing that makes the church, but they're an integral part of the architecture, the underlying structure, the constituent part of what constitutes Catholicism. And so, you know, union with the church includes union with the hierarchy, union with the clergy, union with the sacramental system, public worship, and so forth. And so to break the sacrament of baptism away from all of that is to kind of misunderstand the purpose of the sacrament, and which is why the church generally will withhold baptism unless there's A, danger of death, or B, some well-founded expectation that this child or this person will receive instruction and actually carry on with the practice of the Catholic faith. So it's not recommended that you perform such a baptism. If you did, it would be valid, but illicit.
Okay. Michael, thanks for checking in from Granite City. In a moment, we'll talk with Kate on Long Island, also Harold in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. A couple lines open for you as well, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Delighted to be with you live on this Monday, the 5th of January. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Hey, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? That's some of the things we talk about each and every day here on Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. You can weigh in at 833 888-EWTN. If you have a, you know, something to say about the Catholic faith, maybe you just don't get it. Well, there's some things we can unpack for you. 833-288-3986. Kate is on Long Island. She's listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Kate, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Dr. Antas, you were talking about the infallibility of the Pope earlier in the show. So it brought to question, this question in my mind about Pope Leo XIV. I heard that he has declared that Blessed Virgin Mary is not co-redemptrix. And I believe that goes about against the Catholic doctrine that's been established for a very long time. I wanted your thoughts on that. And I don't know, I thought of another question, which if you have time to answer. At one time, people of another faith had asked me about proof of our Blessed Virgin Mary, her death and assumption. So my question to you is, do we know anything in history or in any kind of document about the death of Jesus' parents? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So let me deal with the co-redemptrix business first of all. Pope Leo did not say, that Mary is not co-redemptrix. What he did say is that the title of co-redemptrix is not appropriately applied to the Blessed Virgin Mary. It's not the same thing. Secondly, it has never been a dogma of the Church that Mary is co-redemptrix. The language of co-redemptrix is a devotional title that Catholics lovingly have applied to the Blessed Virgin Mary, but devotional titles are not dogma, and it has never been proclaimed as a dogma. And the Pope who was fondest of the phrase was John Paul II. He loved to call Mary co-redemptrix, and he very consciously and deliberately refrained from pronouncing the title as a dogma of concerning the Blessed Virgin Mary. And let me unpack the why and the how of that a little bit. So, Kate, it is a doctrine of the Catholic faith that, don't get mad at me for saying this here, this is true. You are co-redemptrix, and Tom Price is co-redeemer, and Pedro Quiles over here, my producer, is co-redeemer, and I, pitiful excuse of a worm as I am also co-redeemer in the following respect. St. Paul says that we have become Christ's co-laborers as if God were making his appeal through us. And what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ, we can fill up in the sufferings of our own flesh, right? The whole, the concept of redemptive suffering, right? The idea that we can pray, we can serve, we can love through the grace of God that we receive from Christ, and that our prayers and our sufferings and our merits can have a positive impact on conveying the grace of God to somebody else. I mean, if that weren't the case, then why would you ever pray that another soul receive grace? What is the point of my saying, God, please grant grace to my friend, if I think that my prayers, my intercession on that soul's behalf, is of no value? It would be pointless. It would be pointless to pray for such a thing if I couldn't actually have the hope of efficacious prayers on that person's behalf. What would be the point of offering my sufferings for another soul if there were no redemptive value therein? But the Church says, I can do that. I can offer my sufferings and my prayers. In the morning offering, we say, you know, dear Jesus, through the Immaculate Heart of Mary, I offer you my prayers, works, joys, sorrows, and sufferings for the desires of your most sacred heart, right? For the intentions of the Holy Father and the intentions of all. We can do this. If we're doing that, what are we doing? We're participating in the work of redemption. Thus, you're co-redemptrix, I'm co-redeemer. Now, Mary does that to a much more eminent degree. Her prayers are a lot more efficacious. Her merits are much greater. So much greater, right? And so that's why someone would say, let's apply this title to her in a kind of unique way to highlight her unique role in redemption, because her intercession and her witness and her holy life is the archetype of Christian charity and obedience. And yet, the reason the Church would say, we're not going to make a dogma out of this, and why Pope Leo says it's probably not the most helpful Marian title, is that the words themselves are ambiguous and can be obscure their meaning can be obscure, and they can actually obscure the truth of the doctrine of redemption. And so, I mean, most commonly, when our Protestant brothers and sisters hear the language of co-redemptrix, they're coming at the doctrine of redemption from such a different place. They deny that anybody can be a participant in the work of redemption, right? So they would think, many of them, not all of them, many of them would think that, say, the grace of God is entirely unilaterally given by God's discretion and not in response to human merit or human prayer. And that would include not in response to Mary's, but also not in response to yours or mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so any notion that Christ might share the work of redemption with anyone, you know, our Protestant friends would regard that as a kind of blasphemy. And they wouldn't see the Marian doctrine in the larger context of the Catholic doctrine of redemption, right? They would be evaluating it in terms of their own kind of truncated doctrine of redemption, in which it would seem to them to be a kind of sacrilege or idolatry. So it's a stumbling block for Protestants. It can also be a stumbling block to Catholics if the doctrine of Mary's co-redeeming activities obscures the fact that every Catholic actually has the right and duty of also participating not only in their own redemption, but that of their neighbors. And so because of that, the title can be confusing. It can be misconstrued, both on the Protestant side or from the Catholic side. And so Pope said, there are better titles. He didn't say the doctrine's untrue. He said the title was inappropriately applied to the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Okay, very good. And what about Kate's second question?
Oh, yeah. So we don't really have anything by way of direct historical evidence. We do have some legendary accounts. The problem is they don't agree.
Oh.
Right? They're diverse accounts. There are accounts in which the Blessed Virgin Mary dies and is assumed to heaven. There are accounts in which she is assumed directly to heaven. There is an episode from the Fourth Ecumenical Council, Council of Chalcedon, when the Roman Emperor at the time inquired after the possibility of obtaining some first-class relics of Mary and was informed by St. Juvenal, ain't none of those around because she took them all to heaven, right?
Yeah.
So we know that the tradition that she didn't leave behind any bodily remains
right.
was already well established, but that's kind of a sort of a negative proof. You know, it's absence of evidence not being mm-hmm. evidence of absence, but like we ain't got no relics because church says she's not around.
Sure.
You know.
Appreciate that. Kate, thanks so much for your call from Long Island today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Harold listening in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and on the EWTN app. Hello, Harold. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm a cradle Catholic, and when I was very young, I was married for a very short time in the Catholic Church and then got divorced. I later got remarried in a civil ceremony to my current wife. We've been married for 29 years and have two kids. When I applied for an annulment, it was denied because they said my witness statements were hearsay. That was the only reason they gave. I think I'm a pretty good Catholic. I go to church every week, holy days, sometimes daily mass, teach my children the Catholic faith, guide them, etc. I try to keep the commandments and live the Beatitudes as best as I can, but I'm a little discouraged because of not being able to go to confession and be absolved of my sins and not being able to receive communion. With all of that being said, Pope Francis, in his encyclical Amoris Laetitia, stated that someone in my circumstance should consult with their pastor and address the irregular circumstances, and some priests may offer confession with absolution and also offer Holy Communion. It also occurred to me that the Last Supper happened before the sacrament of confession was initiated by Christ, so most likely some of the apostles were in a state of mortal sin at that time. And also, unless a priest goes to confession immediately before saying Mass, he could have a pretty high probability of committing a mortal sin prior to receiving communion, since he's always the first one to receive communion at Mass. I'm looking for your opinion on this circumstance and how to stay positive with the Catholic faith when it seems that I am between a rock and a hard place.
Sure. I really appreciate the question. And I get the dilemma you're in, and my heart goes out to you. It really does. And I want to try and be as helpful as I can. So I have a couple things to say. The first one, look, I am not a canon lawyer, and I cannot give canon law advice. But, you know, if you were my friend, I would first thing I would do is urge you to dig a little bit deeper on the details of the annulment and see if there's any possibility of opening that case. And I would talk to some people who are very knowledgeable in that field, because it doesn't sound like, you know, the church did a thorough investigation and found positive grounds for validity. It's, you know, they didn't find compelling evidence of invalidity, and so they're just going to presume the validity of the sacrament. But I don't know enough about the procedure. This is why you have to consult with an expert. But if new grounds were forthcoming, perhaps that thing could be looked at again, because the circumstances of your annulment are, so many people in similar circumstances would have a different outcome, is what I'm saying. And again, I'm not trying to prejudice the thing, and I respect the decision of the tribunal, but like, maybe you should talk to some canon lawyers and just press on that a little bit harder and make sure you've exhausted every opportunity for an annulment. That's number one. The next thing is there's a line of reasoning that you've engaged in, a kind of justification that you're trying to come up with that I think is fishy, right? And that is, well, you know, these other people might have gone to communion in mortal sin, and maybe they're even people who have, you know, strong, like, beyond ordinary reason to not do that. Maybe the apostles did, maybe a parish priest did, and so forth. With respect to the apostles, I think that's pretty shaky, honestly. I think that's pretty shaky. I mean, the church regards the apostles as saints, meaning that they are exemplars of Christian holiness. Doesn't mean they never made mistakes, but to presume that the apostles were in the state of mortal sin at the time of the institution of the supper, I think, would be tremendously presumptuous and really not in keeping with the spirit of Catholic faith and devotion towards the apostles. The expectation on the part of the parish priest is that he will in fact celebrate the sacraments worthily. And in fact, the grace of ordination, you know, ordination comes with sanctifying grace. The grace of ordination is specifically ordered to the worthy celebration of the sacraments. And so if a priest celebrates the sacraments unworthily, then he is doing something that's really quite bad. It's mortal sin 2.0, right? It, you know, because he's done a bad thing, but he kicks up the level of sacrilege, right? And there are obviously priests that live habitually in mortal sin. I mean, we know that is the case. But the expectation of the office is that the priest ought to be an exemplar of holiness. And, you know, barring some extraordinary evidence to the contrary, we should presume the best of our clerical leaders, and certainly hope and pray that they would celebrate the sacraments worthily, that is to say, in the state of grace. So I wouldn't presume that about that. And even if they did, it certainly wouldn't justify sacrilegious communion on your own part. And even as the priest receives sanctifying grace to celebrate the sacrament worthily, the married receives sanctifying grace to participate in the sacrament of matrimony in a way that is also worthy, right? Finally, it doesn't do you any good to receive Holy Communion in the state of mortal sin. There's no advantage to it, right? It's like taking chemotherapy if you don't have cancer, right? Yeah. Or take an aspirin if you do. Like, it's just the cure is not matching the disease properly, you know.
Right.
And it actually retards your spiritual growth because it makes you presumptuous, right? It doesn't advance it. So there's no reason to do that, right? In terms of what does the church actually say you should do? Well, there are two things. In terms of sort of categorically applicable counsel, John Paul II, in his apostolic exhortation, Familiaris Consortio, says that somebody in your situation could lawfully go to communion and go to confession, receive absolution, if they, in fact, refrained from marital relations in the invalid marriage. So that you don't necessarily have to separate. Sometimes people's lives are entwined in ways that makes that extremely difficult or impossible. But you could arrange your marital life in such a way that there was nothing intrinsically immoral about it, and then you would not be barred from going to communion. All right, that's really hard to do. I grant you that. It is true, Pope Francis contemplated some exceptions to that that he talked about in Moris Laetitia, which, as you correctly mentioned, are worked out in the context of the interior forum with one's confessor, who is not me. And so, you know, if you want to explore interior forum solutions, then you go to the interior forum, that is, in the confessional with your priest, where you have these conversations at a level of granularity that is not appropriate for radio.
Appreciate your call, Harold, from Myrtle Beach. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. If you've been watching EWTN television or listening on the radio the last couple days, you've heard our wonderful coverage of SEEK 2026. It's been a fantastic, fantastic conference, something like 26,000 people attending this year. And one of the great speakers was Father Mike Schmitz, and you can hear him tonight on EWTN Radio on Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year, where he guides you through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 episodes. So tonight you'll hear episode number 5. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you. That's tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, right here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Kevin in Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, I can't hear you guys now.
Fantastic. Go right ahead.
Finally got through to you. I've been trying to call you guys forever. So, I go to the Catholic Church, and I take communion, but I love Father Gary here in Kaiser, Oregon, but I don't see why I need to. I mean, they would say that I should not be taking communion. Well, I totally disagree with that. Why do I not have to take communion? I've received all of the sacraments. I have only been to confession once since 1976. I love the communion wafer. I love the taste of it. It's not actually the body and blood of Christ.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Yeah, great. So, a couple questions for you. Do you think that the bread and the wine symbolize the death of Jesus on the cross?
Yes.
Okay, well, you got half the story then, right? Because the church also teaches that. The church teaches that the double consecration of bread and wine memorializes what happened at Calvary. It does, in fact, teach that. So you got part of the doctrine. We're on our way there, okay? Do you think that your participation in the Eucharist also symbolizes your union with the Catholics around you? That it's a way of, as a ritual gesture that indicates that I belong here and I belong to this community? Is that something you would also believe?
Yes, I would say that is a good thing to believe in.
All right, so we got 2 out of 3. We're building the case now. Okay, we're on the right track. Okay, now one of the things that it apparently does not mean in your case is that it may signal some kind of solidarity with the Catholic community, but it doesn't signal solidarity with the Catholic community specifically in its belief about the Eucharist. So, if one of the acts of communion is to signal my solidarity with the community that is constructed, that comes into existence around that sacrament, then isn't it kind of a performative contradiction if I signal by my actions a uniformity that I don't actually adhere to? Do you follow what I'm saying?
I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, so basically, let me put it in real simple language. One of the things that communion says ritually is, I believe what this community believes. Like, I belong to the Catholic community and I believe what Catholics believe. Going to communion signals that. That's one of its meanings, is that I agree with what this community teaches. So if I go to communion, but I don't believe what the community teaches, then I'm sort of involved in a performative contradiction, right? My actions are not congruent with my thinking. Does that make sense?
Not sure.
Okay. You don't believe in the doctrine of the real presence. All the Catholics around you do believe in the doctrine of the real presence, or at least they're supposed to. Going to communion ritually testifies to the people around you, we're together on this. We believe the same thing. But if you don't believe the same thing, then you're saying by your actions something that you deny in your heart. Does that make sense?
Oh, and the people around me don't know that, hey, he's partaking of communion here in the Catholic Church, even though he's Protestant. But I was raised Catholic, and I can partake of that communion, even though they will tell me not to do it because I'm Protestant. Now, if my Catholic aunt died in the wool, was with me today, and I would not partake of communion if she was with me because I know what it means to her.
Okay.
Because of what it means to her, okay. It does not mean to me.
Okay, great, great. So we're getting someplace here. We're making some progress. My point is that the act of Holy Communion is not something whose meaning is completely subjective. It has an established meaning in the community of the Catholic Church. And when you participate in it, the Catholic community rightly presumes, they may presume incorrectly, but I mean they with justice presume, oh, here's somebody going to communion. This person shares with us the Catholic faith. Because that's what the action means. The meaning of communion is, I am in communion with you people. We share the faith in common. They would not be fools for thinking that. Like if you present yourself in the communion line, you are testifying to the people around you, I believe what you believe. But you tell me, I don't believe what they believe, and therefore your act of Holy Communion has a note of dishonesty about it. Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't make sense.
Okay. It doesn't make sense, or you just don't agree?
Nobody around me knows what I believe.
Exactly. Exactly. That's true. So they presume from your actions that you must be a believing Catholic. You're withholding that truth from them. You're not telling them the truth. But your actions would suggest to the people. I mean, if I go to communion at church on Sunday and there's a guy in line in communion in front of me, I would be forgiven for thinking he's probably a Catholic. Right? I mean, he's in communion in the communion line at a Catholic church. That's usually where Catholics go. Right? And that's where Catholics are supposed to go. And the church doesn't invite non-Catholics. So if somebody's in the communion line with me, I would be forgiven for presuming that they're probably Catholic. Right? And it may be the guy in front of me may not be Catholic, and he may think the Catholic Church is stupid and that the whole communion line thing is crazy and it ought to be done this way. All that's beside the point, right? That the community is inviting him to testify to his faith in the Catholic religion through that act of communion. And if he goes to communion, then he is, whether he wants to or not, he's testifying by his actions that he believes something that he does not in fact believe. And therefore, he's involved in a kind of performative contradiction. And so my counsel to you, look, I can't come to Oregon and police your communion, and I'm not about to, right, is that that just like you would refrain from communion out of deference to your aunt, you should refrain from communion out of deference to the Catholic community, who is all your aunt. Like, we're all your aunt and your uncle and your brother and your cousin and your son and your daughter, like, as Christians. And even as you would do that for the sake of your aunt and her conscience, you should show the same respect to your Catholic brothers and sisters who are presuming the best of you in handing you Holy Communion.
Kevin, thanks so much for your call. Please know that we're praying for you as we pray for all of our listeners here on EWTN and specifically Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. Unfortunately, we are flat out of time. I knew this was going to be a popular day because back on the air. And so we could not get to Frank in Florida. We couldn't get to Tom in Lincoln, Nebraska. We couldn't get to Sebastian in Massachusetts. There's another call coming in right now. Just can't handle it. Obviously, here comes the music. So please call us back tomorrow. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for everybody listening in today. We will be back at it tomorrow at the same time, 2 p.m. Eastern. Be sure to check out the podcast. Pedro will have that posted ASAP. In the next couple hours or so, and that'll be at EWTN.com/podcasts. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.